Let's look at the dorsal columns. Now, the dorsal columns are going to bring in vibration and also proprioception. Vibration is going to be the actual phenomenon of things vibrating. But proprioception is going to be our perception of where our body is in space. So proprioception is going to be benefiting us when we walk, when we stand, when we sit, whatever. It tells us where we are in space. Now, the two dorsal columns are going to be on each side of the spine. Remember, there's going to be that intermediary area, or that intermediary area in the spinal cord, and that posterior part. Remember, we looked at the posterior horns, and we said that the posterior columns are going to be between the horns, and we said that there's a posterior median sulcus, and either side of the posterior median sulcus are going to be two dorsal columns. So we have a total of four dorsal columns, two on the right of the posterior median sulcus, and two on the left of the posterior median sulcus. So we really talk about just two of them, so we know that these are going to be reproduced on the other side. We talk about the fasciculus gracile and also the fasciculus cuneatus. The fasciculus gracile is going to carry signals from the leg. This is going to be sensory from the leg. So if you have a tuning fork on your knee, you would be perceiving that from the fasciculus gracile. Now if you had a tuning fork on your arm, you would perceive that from the fasciculus cuneatus. Remember, cuneatus means it's like cuneiform shape, so cube-shaped. And gracile is easy because remember the gracilis muscle? We said the gracilis muscle was thin, like a piece of grass. So this also is a thinner portion of the posterior column, whereas the fasciculus cuneatus is a little thicker. So the fasciculus gracile, easy. The signals come from the leg, so like the gracilis muscle. And just remember that the other one, the fasciculus cuneatus, is carrying signals from the arm itself. Now these guys are going to in the medulla, unlike the spinal thalamic tract that decussated at the spinal cord, these guys decussate in the medulla. So the third order neuron is going to be in the thalamus, which carries signals to the what of the brain. You should know because it's a sensory, it's going to bring it to the what of the brain. That, of course, is going to be the postcentral gyrus. At this juncture, we should talk about first order, second order, and third order neurons. In the sensory tracts, they have three different neurons. The first neuron, the first order neuron, is the one that's going to be bringing the information into the spinal cord and then going up to the first decussation. Or it could stay at the spinal cord, as is the case in the spinal thalamic tract, and just decussate there. The point is that the first order neuron brings in the information all the way up to the decussation. Then, after the decussation, we get the second order neuron, which brings the information up to the thalamus. Then from the thalamus, we're going to be going to the postcentral gyrus, and that's going to be our third order neuron. So the first order brings it in, the information in, all the way up to the decussation. From the decussation to the thalamus is going to be the second order neuron. And the third order neuron is always going to go from the thalamus to the postcentral gyrus. Those are the three order neurons. So for our perception, or proprioception, our perception of us in space, if we were to stand right now and just raise your right leg, you would see that you would go one way or the other, or maybe stand there perfectly. What's happening is joints are picking up where you are in space. That's your proprioception. If you close your eyes, you'll see that your proprioception will have to take over even more. Sometimes people fall over or whatever. This is one thing that you can really get good at, because your proprioception can be trained really, really quickly. No matter how old you are, you can increase your balance just by doing this exercise. By raising your right foot and trying to stand on it with your eyes open and closed. And do that for so, and you'll see that you'll improve greatly. The goal is to stand on both legs, stand on your right leg for a count of 30, stand on your left leg for a count of 30, with your eyes see that if you can't do it now, if you keep doing it, then you will gain your balance. And this is very important for, particularly for older individuals. Now let's look at motor tracks. Motor tracks are going to be a part of an area of the brain stem that looks very, very much like a pyramid. So if we think of a pyramid being a broad-based structure, and then going up like a triangle, but of course having four sides, that's sort of the area of the neurological area. So they call it the pyramidal tracts. So we have two pyramidal tracts. We have an anterior or ventral. We also have a lateral. And they all have the same last name, and that's corticospinal tract. Cortex. The brain itself is often called the cortex. Remember that things that are outside of an organ, we'll call them the cortex. Things that are inside of the organ, we call the medulla. So we talked about the medulla oblongata, which is going to be this. It's going to be an oblong area that's going to be in the middle of the brain stem. Medulla meaning inside, and oblongata meaning oblong. Whereas this is called the cortex. So the brain, remember the gray matter of the brain, where all heads of the aardvarks are, where all the soma of the neurons are going to be in the gray matter. And this is the cortex. So that's why we call it the cortical spinal tract, or the brain spine tract. So we see then that the information is going to be going down the spinal cord in these tracts, from the cortex brain to the spine. So that's going to be the phenomena that we're going to see here. Now the cortical spinal tract being a track, we would expect it to coordinate our movements, and indeed it does. Now, unlike the sensory tracts that have three order neurons, the descending or motor tracts only have two neurons. They call one neuron the upper motor neuron, and the other one is the lower motor neuron. The upper motor neuron will tend to be more in the central nervous system. The lower motor neuron will tend to be more in the lower peripheral nervous system, even though it's still part of the central nervous system. But if we try to perceive what goes on with the upper and lower motor neurons, we'll see that they're going to have a distinction. Like, for instance, if we were to have a problem with one or the other, we would have different things that would be occurring. The upper motor neuron really would be more involved with what's going on with the brain itself. The lower motor neuron is going to be, said, lower down. It's going to be more the brain stem, more the spinal cord, more the peripheral nerves. So when we see these things, then we're going to be perceiving that it's going to be a lower motor neuron. And we'll talk more about this later. But for now, let's just talk about what's going on with this, with the anatomy of the cortical spinal tract. First of all, the two neuron pathways are going to start. First of all, the upper motor neuron is going to start in the brain, the precentral gyrus, yes, because we know that all motor comes from the precentral gyrus. So we're going to be having these descending tracts going into the spinal cord, but before that happens, we're going to be seeing that one of them is going to be decussating or crossing. That's going to be our lateral cortical spinal tract. Our lateral cortical spinal tract will decussate in the medulla. Our anterior cortical spinal tract will not decussate until it gets to the spine. So it's going to travel on the same side all the way down the spinal cord until it gets to the spine, then it's going to go over to the other side. That's our anterior cortical spinal tract. The way to remember where things cross is to think of the word medulla. We have the dorsal columns. We have the lateral cortical spinal tract. Both of these decussate in the medulla. The spinal thalamus, easy, because we know it has spinal in there, so that's where it crosses. Then all we have to do is just remember that the anterior cortical spinal also decussates in the spine. Then we have spinal nerves. We have 31 pairs of spinal nerves, as we mentioned. So we have 31 on the right side, 31 on the left side. We have one pair of coccygeal nerves, which makes sense. We have five pairs of sacral nerves, which makes sense because we have five fused vertebrae. We have five 5 pairs of lumbar nerves, which makes sense since we have 5 lumbars. It's no surprise that we have 12 pairs of thoracic nerves, since we have 12 thoracics. The surprise comes in when we look at the cervical nerves. We have 8 pairs, and yet we only have how many cervical vertebrae? 7. So, that means that somehow we've got an extra nerve here. So the way we do this is we're going to name nerves after their bones until we get out of the cervicals. So, for instance, when we look at the spinal nerves exiting, they're always going to exit above their respective vertebrae until we get out of the cervicals. Then we're going to be having them go inferior to the vertebrae. So, let's go. With C1, we're going to see it exiting superior to the C1 vertebrae. So, C1 nerve is going to exit superior to the C1 vertebrae. The C5 nerve will exit superior to the C5 vertebrae. The C6 nerve will exit superior to the C6 vertebrae. The C7 nerve will exit superior to C7, but C8 nerve will exit below the C7 vertebrae. And then subsequent from there, you'll always have the respective nerve below that vertebrae. So if we went down to L5, the L5 nerve would exit below the L5 vertebrae. So that's basically the way it works. So in the cervicals, upper cervicals, the nerve will go above the respective vertebrae. Getting into the thoracics and lumbars and sacral, they're always going to be going below their respective vertebrae. So this is helpful if we have, for instance, a disc problem at the L5, S1 disc, we would expect L5 become compromised, not S1, because L5 would be right there, going below their respective vertebrae. As we look further at spinal nerves, we come out from the spinal cord. The first part that we're going to meet anatomically is called the root. These roots are what made the arachnoid look like it was a spider web. So we have the roots coming out of the spinal cord or going into the spinal cord. If it's a dorsal or sensory root, that of course is going to be going into the spinal cord. If it's a motor or a ventral root or anterior root, it's going to be going out of the cord because it's motor. So we're going to see these roots. And then we're going to, after we see these roots, then we're going to see that they're going to be going more peripheral. They're going to be going out. So when we are first looking at our nerve will have the roots, and the roots will be separated into sensory and motor. But then as we go to the periphery, or as we start to go out from the spinal cord, we're going to get to an area called the IVF, or the intervertebral foramen. And this area is where the two vertebrae, one above and one below, make a little hole. So the vertebrae can go through that hole. But the hole can be, of course, compromised because it's between two vertebrae. If one vertebrae were to tilt on another one, it could pinch that nerve. And that's the premise behind chiropractic. We want to move that bone away from that nerve so that it has room for it to go through and it won't be irritated. We don't want any pressure on it because we know that nerves hate pressure. So once we get to the IVF, after that, or the intervertebral foramen, after that we're going to have a mixed nerve. Before that we have motor, which is going to be posterior, and sensory that's going to be posterior, motor that's going to be anterior. And then it's going to become mixed at the IVF, and now we can't distinguish whether it's the nerve is motor or whether or not it's sensory, because it's now mixed up. So oftentimes when a person has a phenomenon, such as a numbness in their hand, for instance, that will be followed by, as it gets worse, it'll be followed by motor problems. So in other words, the reflexes may be off. So sometimes, or they'll have the reflexes off first, and then they'll have a sensory problem. So because they're mixed nerves, you never know which one you're going to be getting, but you know that if the nerve is upset, you're going to be getting either a sensory or a motor aspect problem. Now as the nerves go out, they also are going to send off communicating branches, and these are called rami. something that is complex. They just don't put the com in there. They just say it's plexus. So a plexus is going to be an area where we're going to be having complex nerves. These are going to be occurring in our arms and in our legs because this is where the most complex neurology is. This will not be occurring in the thoracic spine, however. It's not that complex here. All we need to do is have our nerves go to our muscles that are going to be going to our ribs. And that's basically it. We also, of course, need our nerves to go to our organ systems, but they don't use plexuses. The muscles are what uses most of the plexuses. That's why we have an abundance of them in the cervical area and in the lumbar. Look at the nerve plexuses. We have two up and we have two down. The two up are going to be the cervical plexus with C1 to C5. The brachial plexus is going to follow that, which is going to be C5 to C8 and also T1. Now, notice that we have an overlapping of the cervical and the brachial plexus at C5. This is the redundancy of the nervous system that we talked to you about before. We want this overlap so we don't put all of our eggs in one basket. The significance of the cervical plexus is one nerve, and that's going to be called the phrenic nerve. The phrenic nerve is important because it goes to the diaphragm. It allows us to breathe. The brachial plexus, however, is indeed that. It's complex, and it's going to go to our arm. We expect it to be complex because we have so many things we need to do with our hands. So these are going to be multiple nerves. The two down are going to be the lumbar and the sacral plexus. The lumbar plexus only has one nerve. Sacral plexus only has one nerve that we're concerned with. Notice that the lumbar plexus goes from L1 to L4, and that the sacral plexus goes from L4 to S4, so the sacral 4 nerve. Notice that L4 is going to overlap. Once again, this is called the redundancy of the nervous system, not putting all your eggs in one basket. So the simplest are going to be the cervical, the lumbar, and the sacral plexus. More difficult is going to be the brachial plexus, only because it has so many more. Let's look at the cervical plexus. Damage to the cervical plexus can affect the diaphragm muscle or can cause problems with breathing. So a person could die just from having trauma to this. So breathing stops because the phrenic nerve no longer sends information to the diaphragm. Remember the diaphragm, as we inhale, diaphragm contracts and our diaphragm goes into our abdomen. So it actually goes down. As it does that, it pulls the thoracic cage. Able to breathe, and then when it relaxes, it does just the opposite. So breathing is very important, obviously. So if we don't breathe, we're not going to live. So that's why this is such an important area of our spine. So the mnemonic that's classic, that's been used forever in all anatomy classes, is the mnemonic C3, 4, and 5, keep the diaphragm alive. Because the phrenic nerve has its origin from the nerve C3, nerve C4, and nerve C5. So if there is damage, then of course this could cause some problems. The famous actor, what was his name? Christopher Reeve. He was Superman. He had a trauma from an equestrian event. I think he fell off a horse. And he fractured C2. Because C2 vertebrae is C3 underneath it. Remember, C3 nerve is going to go above C3 vertebrae. If you fracture or cause trauma to C2, that could affect, and in his case, did affect his diaphragm. So when we look at the cervical plexus, we see it's going to go from C1 to C5, and the phrenic nerve is most important. But also, one other thing that's of interest is a little loop called the cervical loop. And the cervical loop is also called the ansa cervicalis. The ansa cervicalis is where we have the cervical nerves actually making a loop. They send off nerves that go to the thyroid, to the hyoid muscles. So we have the hyoid being supplied by the ansa cervicalis. So if I were to ask you what are the nerves that go to the hyoid muscles, you would of course know. Now, Let's talk about the brachial plexus. The brachial plexus, as we said, is going to have a variety of nerves. It has five nerves. These five nerves are going to be the axillary, the musculocutaneous, the median nerve, the ulnar nerve, and also the radial nerve. So the axillary nerve is going to be the nerve that's going to go to the deltoid, the teres minors, both sides, and also to the armpit, which makes sense, axillary armpit. We also have the musculocutaneous nerve. This is going to be going to the flexors of the arm and the forearm, and also a cutaneous sensation of the forearm. The median nerve, as the name implies, is going to go to the middle part of the anterior part of our arm, and this is going to also go to the hand, to the palm. It's going to take care of the first three fingers. You're going to get that nerve going there. Also, the ulnar nerve is going to take care other part of the anterior part. So that's going to be your second tooth, or your last two fingers. That's going to be our ulnar nerve. Then our radial nerve is going to take care of the back of the hand, the back of the arm. When we look at the brachial plexus, we see it's very, very complex. Injury to the brachial plexus can cause a wrist drop. So you actually have your wrist just not working. Why? Because the radial, or the posterior part of the hand is not working. So because that's paralyzed, you're going to be having a spasm of the anterior muscles, and it's going to cause a wrist drop.